Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. On today's show, we're going to speak with the commander of the 148th Fighter Wing. We'll hear about the Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp, and we'll check in with the County Veteran Service Officer. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Sean Menke.
Your Minnesota National Guard is a unique military organization in that we have a dual role. Our chain of command includes both our governor and our president. We serve both overseas in combat roles and here at home in response to state emergencies. More than 13,000 strong, the soldiers and airmen of your Minnesota National Guard are based in more than 60 communities across our great state. From our Air National Guard units in Duluth and the Twin Cities to our Army National Guard units stationed in Rosemont, Bloomington, St. Paul, Camp Ripley, and elsewhere, the soldiers and airmen of your Minnesota National Guard live here, work here, and serve here. It is our mission to be a good community partners. We partner with local law enforcement agencies, schools, and an assortment of community organizations as part of our counter drug program. In our role as emergency management response agency, we're prepared to protect Minnesota from any hostility, be it winter weather, floods, wildfires, civil unrest, or a pandemic. While I'm in the community, people often stop me to thank me for my service. I'm always humbled by that gesture of gratitude, but I'm also proud in the knowledge that the Minnesota National Guard is always ready to protect our community and always there to respond. Thank you.
Thank you, General Menke. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me in the studio right now is Colonel Nathan Asta. Colonel Asta is the commander of the 148th Fighter Wing. It's a Minnesota Air National Guard unit up in Duluth, Minnesota. Up there, he's got the responsibility for organizing, training, equipping, and maintaining combat-ready forces that encompass over 1,000 airmen and airwomen. Also, the about 22 Block 50 F-16 aircraft, 221-acre installation, and a budget probably with inflation well over $65 million now. Colonel Asta, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Well, thanks, Doug, for having me on the show.
Boy, that's a lot of responsibility up there in Duluth, Minnesota. 221 acres, you got a good budget, you've got a lot of airmen and women up at the 148th. How are things up in Duluth?
Things up there are great. You know, right next to Lake Superior, up by the airport, it's a beautiful installation. We have great people up there, over 1,000 of us working, over 450 day in and day out come to work there every day. So it's a great facility, great people, and a great mission.
Well, I was looking at your bio, and I want to hear a little bit about your history, what brought you into the Minnesota Air National Guard, ultimately the commander. But here are a couple of the things that I pulled out as I was looking through your bio. You've got over 3,800 hours of flight time in the F-16. You've flown a T-37, T-38 in addition to the F-16. You've got 80 combat sorties, 417 or more combat hours, and that averages about 5.5 hours per sortie. Those are some interesting things to me because, one, I really enjoyed the F-16 aircraft, having had the opportunity to temporarily pilot one of those things in the back seat. But tell us just a little bit about you, about your military history, and then ultimately what brought you to Minnesota.
Okay. I grew up or was born up in Virginia, Minnesota, up on the Iron Range, moved down to St. Cloud, where I attended high school at St. Cloud Tech High School. Graduated, knew I wanted to fly fighters, didn't know the best way to do it, except I saw that the Air Force Academy was probably giving the most amount of pilot slots out of anybody. So I applied, got my nomination, and went there. Went there for 4 years. After I graduated in 1999, went to pilot training in Columbus, Mississippi. Did well enough there to get the F-16. Went over to Phoenix, Arizona at Luke Air Force Base, just in the west side of Phoenix there, and learned how to fly the F-16. And then I did 3 operational tours in Idaho, Alaska, and Italy. Before I ended up leaving the active duty service to come to the Air National Guard. What's funny is I thought Duluth was going to lose their F-16s. So my thought was, I'm going to go fly F-16s in South Carolina. Well, my wife's grandmother, 80 years old, sends us a clipping from the newspaper, the St. Cloud Times, that said, no, Duluth's getting new aircraft. And that was right around 2008, 2009 timeframe. So grandma thankfully sent us that clipping. And I made a trip to Duluth, met with the command team, and they offered me a job. And I joined the Minnesota Air National Guard in 2010, and I've been here ever since.
And then you became the commander of the 148th back in September of 2022.
I did. I was a line pilot there for a while. I ended up being the squadron commander. Then I moved on to the group commander. Now I'm the wing commander.
Well, it's one thing that everybody should know in the listening audience is that grandmas always know best.
Grandmas do know best.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you here in the studio and share a little bit about your experiences. And we do want to talk about the 148th because when I left the service in 2019, the concept we're going to talk about today, I don't think I'd ever heard it. Now, it may have been discussed, but I don't know what this Agile Combat Employment or ACE doctrine is. And I'd like to know if you can just share a little bit about that with me, with the listening audience.
Yeah. So historically, the Air Force has operated from main operating bases hundreds of miles from the action. And they were able to fly into the combat zones and operate and support either getting air supremacy or supporting troops on the ground. Well, in today's new threat environment, the Air Force is kind of changing the way it thinks about operations. And it's moving towards a more distributed operation. No longer will Air Force bases be free of threat and be sanctuaries. So the agile combat employment theory is we will operate more in small teams. We will be agile. And we're going to move much more rapidly than what we have in the past.
Now, how is that different from what traditional deployments have been? In my experience with the Air National Guard in particular, a lot of the deployments generally are smaller units anyway or smaller groups of airmen. So that's just – is that this what you're talking about kind of unique because of the aircraft side of things or the fighter capacity that you have?
The fighter capacity. So historically, let's just talk Afghanistan, where in 2012 we went to Kandahar Kandahar, where that base had 30, 40,000 people on it. It was a well-established air base, and we could operate there fairly uncontested. You know, some rocket attacks on the base, but generally speaking, it was pretty free of threat. And so we would operate. We would take our 12 jets and, you know, our 300, 400 people with us, and we would operate, and we would support the folks on the ground. Well, we feel in the future that those big bases are at risk to being attacked, so we have to distribute ourselves into smaller, more agile locations.
And it's interesting because we've had the Army side on the radio show before, and they talked about some of the same type of new strategies coming in, you know, for example, with bringing back the artillery, you know, something that because of current needs, current operational needs, or the way the leadership is seeing things moving in the future, it's a necessary thing. So this new agile combat way of equipping or mobilizing. So the 148th then, because you are a fighter wing, you need to somehow adjust to learn how to operate in that type of a capacity.
That's right. So it's a learning across the spectrum. So it's learning from our leaders how to operate, to deploy with smaller units. It is learning instead of going to large air bases now, we may have to go to smaller air bases that may not have all the infrastructure that we're used to. So that would affect what you pack to bring to support that. You know, the airfield, you may take a little bit more risk. It might be a shorter runway than what you're used to. You may not be operating with arresting cables that are on the end. So there's a little bit more risk there. And then also the airmen, you're not going with as big of a package any longer. So your airmen have to learn how to do more than the one or two tasks that they had traditionally done. So that concept is called multi-capable airmen. So these airmen are training to more than just their core tasks, which takes on some risk. You only have so much time with these airmen, especially in the Air National Guard, where they only, if they're traditional M-Day or drill status, you only have limited time with those airmen. So getting them the training at their core tasks, but then also additional tasks is a little bit more of a challenge.
Yeah, I can see that. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about how the 148th is adjusting to this new concept. We're speaking with Colonel Nathan Asta. He's the 148th commander up in Duluth, Minnesota. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. We've been speaking with Colonel Nathan Asta. He's the commander up at the 148th Fighter Wing in Duluth, Minnesota. Colonel, before we went into break, we're talking a little bit about the Air Force's agile combat employment. You're talking about multi-capable airmen and just kind of the interesting ways in which airmen now are going to have to operate in this new type of environment. So is the concept already in play right now? Is the Air Force actively engaged in this, or is this a concept coming down the road?
It is in play, but it's also developing based on the theater of operations you are in. It might be different in Europe than it is in the Pacific, but it is in play as we speak.
All right. So basically, you know, it's kind of that the commander obviously makes that assessment and has to determine at what stage they can be, because security has to be a huge concern, especially as you bring less people. Maybe less aircraft. I would believe that that might leave you to be a little bit more vulnerable. How do you interact with that, or how do you combat the security risk? And then to dovetail on that, what are you doing up at the 148th now to prepare your fighter wing to take on this new concept or employ this new concept?
It definitely is carries a little bit more risk when you're asking people to do more than what their traditional tasks are. So much like the Marine Corps, where they say, you know, everyone's a rifleman, you may have to do multiple tasks, and that might be pulling security. So if you're a jet engine mechanic, or you're a fueler where you're bringing in the fuel truck, you might have to have the rifle and pull security on your off time. And that's just part of it to be able to do this with these smaller teams.
Interesting. So training then. At the 148th, I mean, obviously, you know how to do your mission. You know, it's not like the pilots need to learn how to fly in a different way. You talked about the multi-capable airmen. So now there's probably some cross-training that's going on so that a particular airman can do more things to be more capable on the ground. So what are the things are you doing then at the 148th? How are you organizing these teams to make sure you are an agile combat employment-ready force?
Yeah, well, we look for key tasks that are similar. So if two people have a job and there's some overlap, that's an easy one. You start training them on both, which just makes sense. And even though this is a little more risky, we do it smartly. So we have a syllabus. We do training on how to do other people's jobs. Maybe not be as good as somebody's primary task, but we do train them in the limited time that we have with them. So that they know how to do that. And then we go out and plan and exercise this. So we just did an exercise a few weeks ago up in Duluth, and we practiced that we were deploying a small package and people were doing multiple jobs. And we find out what areas we're strong in and what areas we're weak in, and we learn from that as we're a learning organization.
So what's the general attitude been from the leadership team, you know, the commanders all the way down to the lowest level airmen? I mean, how are they adapting to this change?
Well, it is a change because historically people have had very defined roles, and we're kind of wading into a new territory that we're learning. So some people are uncomfortable naturally. With any change, people get a little uncomfortable. But again, we do it smartly. We do it in a training environment so they get more comfortable. But generally speaking, the attitudes are great. The teams are smaller, so there's good esprit de corps amongst those teams when they go out and they exercise. They all know each other. It's much smaller of a group. And generally, the morale is very high.
And so are they, or are you then actually compiling like specific teams that if you had to go now, this would be that group of people that are going to go with these multi-capable airmen included in it that have been training together?
We primarily identify people to be multi-capable airmen, and we try to train them on multiple tasks so we have them identified so that if we do have to send them out the door, we're sending the right personnel with the right training to be able to accomplish the job.
Okay. And so you talked about doing some exercises already with your airmen up in Duluth. What does the future look like for the 140th as it relates to this new concept?
Yeah, so not only that exercise we just did recently, about 2 years ago, we went up to the Arctic, up to Thule, Greenland, and we operated with a small team exercising this very concept. So we did that about 2 years ago. And then last year, the unit went on a CENTCOM deployment. And in the midst of that deployment, they did two ACE packages, one to Thumrait, Oman, and the other to Cairo, Egypt. And they took a small team from the main operating base to the smaller outposts, if you will, and they operated for a week or two at each of these locations.
You said that the Air Force is, you know, it's currently in development, right? I mean, here's the concept, but it's always in development. Are you given the opportunity then as a commander to provide your feedback up the chain of command to potentially make additional enhancements to this process? And if so, what are some of those lessons learned that you've learned?
Absolutely, we are. You know, with an Air National Guard unit, as I was talking, we have different challenges than, let's say, a regular component, an active duty component unit. You know, they might be full-time, have a lot more manpower that they can train, and we have our drill status guardsmen, you know, much less of a time. However, you know, that person cranking on an F-16, wrenching on it, might have been doing that for the last 25 years. So just because we have less time with them, they have been around the block for 25 years, and they have that experience, which I think is something we see in the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard is one of our strengths. So we might operate just a little bit differently and force package our personnel differently than other units just based on people's past and experience.
And because, you know, one of the keys to leadership is to know your people. So if you know what they're capable of, it helps you then to put these teams together a little bit better, be smarter about the personnel that you're teaming up so that you have this capability beyond what maybe some other units might have.
Absolutely.
And so with the training you've been doing, with the exercises that you've been doing, obviously lessons learned, is there a requirement to do other types of staffing changes? Like, do you have to, as you move from what you described before as a centralized way of doing business to now to this more of a decentralized, smaller platforms or smaller entities moving out, how does that affect actual staffing or leadership inside of your organization? Because everybody still needs to be led and taken care of.
It does. With these smaller teams, there's going to be more of them out and about. So historically, again, you might have an 05 or an 06 leading some of these deployments or larger organizations on a main operating base. You now might be sending out that 03, 04, or that E7, E8, maybe even E9 to be a leader. So you're pushing down that leadership to lower levels, which historically we haven't done as much on these main operating bases. So it's a leadership challenge for some of these folks. And it's good. So we try to practice this, you know, at small things. Like, let's just send a small team out to Phoenix, Arizona for 3 days and go fly with another unit. And it's led by, you know, 03, 04.
Yeah. And that's the important thing, right? Is because as a leader in an organization, you always have to be ready to step up because you just never know when it's going to be your turn or your number that's called.
That's correct.
Yeah. So interesting. So all right, so back to the Agile Combat Employment, or it's called the ACE Doctrine. When did this first come into existence, or when did the concept first get thrown around?
I think it's been probably within the last three to four-ish years, when we did that pivot to the Pacific, and we realized that there wasn't that many operating bases, that you might have to be on these smaller islands. I think that is where that change kind of occurred.
And from your perspective now, as the wing commander who's got years and years of experience, a lot of time, combat hours, a lot of sorties, right? I mean, doing the thing that you're trying to do, how has it been for you personally as the commander to make this type of a switch? I mean, I know that you've only been the commander since September of last year, but you're still you know, feeling the effects of what the previous commander put into play.
Well, I think with any organization, you just have to accept that there's change. The status quo, if you don't change and you keep the status quo, you won't be successful. So I think you have to first go in with that attitude that whatever the threat is, whatever the leadership, their new vision is, you're going to buy into it, accept it, and you're going to train to it. So I think leadership, having that mentality kind of helps the lower levels get on board with the game plan. Now it's just a matter of identifying how we're going to change our deployments, our training deployments, and get people on board and get them trained correctly.
So it sounds like some interesting times ahead. Last question for you. You've got a young person sitting out there listening to the show right now, or maybe it's a son, daughter, granddaughter, because grandmas know best. What would you say to that person if they're considering joining the Minnesota Air National Guard?
Hey, I can't say enough about the Minnesota Air National Guard, the Minnesota Army National Guard. There are so many opportunities within our organization. We'll train you. If you want to go to school on the outside, you can go to school on the outside, be a traditional guardsman. And you can get skills training and leadership training within our organization. That if you want to be full-time with us, that's great. You can do that. You can also be hold a civilian career on the outside. And those skill sets are transferable. Those leadership, those hardworking skills that we teach you are beneficial for both the civilian and the military career. So I can't speak highly enough about the Minnesota Air National Guard and the Army National Guard.
All right, sir, Colonel, thank you so much for joining us on Minnesota Military Radio today.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
That is Colonel Nathan Asta. He's the 148th Fighter Wing Commander up in Duluth, Minnesota. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. In a moment, we're going to speak with a representative from the Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp. But first, it's time for Commissioner's Corner. It's a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Herkey.
As we near the 4th of July, I'm reminded of the 24-note bugle call, also known as TAPS. Our current version was likely created during the Civil War by Union General Daniel Adams Butterfield. He decided the French Lights Out music was too formal for the daily end-of-day signal. He hummed a version to an aide, who transcribed it to music. General Butterfield then directed the brigade bugler, Oliver Norton, to play the notes, and he made further adjustments to the length of each note. This new call was then played at the end of each day, instead of the regulation call. Word spread, and other buglers adopted the same call. It was even adopted by Confederate buglers. This music was made the official Army bugle call shortly after the war ended, but was not given the name TAPS until 1874. TAPS Out is now played at all military burial and memorial services to accompany the lowering of the flag and to symbolize Lights Out command at day's end.
Thank you, Commissioner Herkey. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me on the phone right now to talk about the Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp is Rich Kemp. Rich has volunteered with the youth camp since its inception and is currently serving on the board of directors as the fundraising director. Rich, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks. Glad to join you.
Rich, you and I go way back. We served together in the Minnesota National Guard, and maybe you can just kind of share a little bit with us about, you know, how many years of service did you have in the Minnesota National Guard?
I served 32 years in the Guard, and then the last 23 were active Guard and Reserve.
So you had a nice long history of service with the Minnesota National Guard, and you know, thank you for your service. But somewhere along in there, there was an idea to put together this camp, and it was for the Minnesota National Guard for the youth, also for the teens. And I'm wondering if you might be able to share just a little bit about the history. When did it come into existence? When was that first camp?
The first camp was in 1991, and we had a one-week camp, and it's 10 to 12-year-old kids, National Guard, Minnesota National Guard members. And so we had the one-week camp, and then it, after a couple of years, we started doing two one-week camps, and so it'll be different kids each week. And the camp itself has always been run by volunteers, so either members of the Guard or family members of those Guard members. So it's always been volunteer run.
So the camp obviously has been around for a long time, since 1991, and you somehow got involved with it at the very beginning. So were you on the initial planning stages of putting the camp together? How did you get tied into being involved with the camp?
My boss at the time was on the board of the initial camp, and so got me to volunteer for that first camp, and I've been doing it ever since. I missed 1 year when I deployed to Iraq.
And I remember we were on that deployment together, and I know that was a tough time because you have been at every camp since, always as a volunteer. And I know that through my experience with the camp, you get a special name. Everybody else is called Camper something, whatever their first name is. So in your case, Camper Rich, but they like to call you Richie Rich. I don't know where that came from.
I don't know. It's just been a long time.
So Richie Rich, Camper Rich, what are the goals of the camp? Why did the camp get created, and really what's its purpose?
Well, the Adjutant General for the Minnesota National Guard at that time was Gene Andreotti, and he was big into family programs and taking care of the families of Guard members, and so, you know, had all these kids that had their parents gone. At that time, it was just, you know, 2 weeks a year and 1 weekend a month, and he wanted to do something for those kids and got a group together to start out the camp. And, you know, as time went along, it wasn't just that 2 weeks a year. Then it was deployments of overseas for a year. One deployment was like almost 24 months. So those kids were, you know, missing their guard member. And so it helped to have other kids who were in the same situation. You know, you go to school and not many other kids know what you're dealing with. And so the camp helps with that, too. They meet other kids who have dealt with deployments and missing their parents or their grandparent or aunt or uncle. And so it's meant a lot to those kids.
And so we know that the National Guard, the reserve components, have changed a lot since 1991. As you mentioned, generally it's, you know, it was 2 weeks a year, 1 weekend a month. And then, of course, as the War on Terror came into existence, that time away, that commitment grew to, you know, multiple days a month to deployments that could last a year or longer. And so what started off, at least what I'm hearing you say, is what started off as a concept of just something to maybe, you know, kind of give back to the kids of the service members back in 91 has really grown into something that is really helpful to get kids together who have experienced or are experiencing some of the similar issues, that being their loved one, mom, dad, or whomever that's currently deployed.
Exactly. You know, probably back when it first started, it was mostly dad, and now it's dad and just as many moms, you know, that are getting deployed, and a lot of grandparents too, and aunts and uncles. And I think it's just a great, you know, I can tell you a story about one of the first camps I was a counselor at. We had a camper who didn't want to be there and started walking away from our group and started running, and so I'm trying to catch him so we don't lose him, and he starts running between the tin huts at Camp Ripley before we finally caught him. And you know, I don't want to be here, my mom made me come, and we got convinced him to stay. And on Saturday after camp, he didn't want to go home, he was having so much fun, he was crying. And that experience happens so much, not necessarily the kids running away from us, but or they don't want to be there that first night, but then after being there for the week, they just don't want to leave. They had so much fun.
That's interesting. I'm sure that, like you said, there's probably multiple stories of kids who have that transformation, right? This might be their first time away from home, and exactly. They don't want to be there. They're homesick, and you've got a loving, caring, compassionate group of volunteers that, you know, make a very safe environment for these kids up at Camp Ripley for that camp. So, Rich, I know it takes a lot of people to put this thing together, and you said it's a 100% volunteer-run force. So how is it that you get the volunteers together? How do you build your staff?
Well, we put the word out, and a lot of word of mouth, and try to get words out to the different units and asking for volunteers. I wanted to say I forgot to mention that after about the first 10 years, it was just the younger kids, 10 to 12-year-olds. And after 10 years, we started teen camp, and then that was 13 to 15-year-olds. And so we have 10 through 12 are the youth camp, 13 through 15 are the teen campers, and then we have junior counselors who are 16 and 17. And then many of those junior counselors went on to become adult counselors with us for many years.
And so I can see the progression here of campers that start off in the youth portion, that 10 to 12 age group, and then they come back for camp again to be in the teen camp. And then they're having so much fun, they come back as junior counselors, and then all of a sudden they're regular counselors, and they've been involved with camp for already 8 years or so.
Right, and both my daughters are involved. My oldest one is in her second year of college, and she went through the junior counselor program and is now an adult counselor, and my younger daughter is a junior counselor at camp, so they love it, and I'm sure they'll be around for a long time.
Well, it's a family tradition in the Kemp family. Rich, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about how maybe camp has changed over the years, and we'll talk about some fundraising. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. I'm speaking with Rich Kemp. Rich is the fundraising director for the Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp. And Rich, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. And let's just get right after it here. You know, the camp's been around for a long time. I know that it's changed quite a bit over the years. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how some of the activities has changed over the years? And then lead into why it is that you're so passionate about this camp and what makes this camp so special to you.
Some of the things we've done, you know, we've done since we started the camp, you know, like a lot of other camps, we have biking and swimming and canoeing and the natural things that kids would do at a camp, you know. And at this camp, we also teach them how to march, and they stay in the barracks where their parents or grandparents or aunt or uncle would stay. And they eat in the dining facility. So they get some of the feelings of what it's like in the military. But what we found after we started the teen camp was we had to change some of the activities because the kids had already done them at youth camp. So we had to add certain things. Like instead of just canoeing on the lake, they canoe down the river. So, you know, we changed some things, but not a lot. And as far as the passion for me, it's just seeing these kids and, you know, what do you see them grow, how much they grow in a week. And they're volunteers, you know, we become great friends. And, you know, the camaraderie in the military, that's just what it's like there, you know.
And I would imagine that even these campers develop some great relationships over that 1 week and maintain those relationships even beyond camp.
They do, and that's what helps get some of the volunteers back because, you know, they find out that one of their friends is volunteering and, hey, maybe I should be doing that. And so then they get in contact and then now we got more volunteers. So, yeah, it's some great relationships have built from the campers there.
So we should point out that the camp is held up at Camp Ripley. It's done annually. It's 2 1-week camps back to back. Rich, are there any eligibility requirements for kids other than the age groups that you already talked about, 10 to 12 and 13 to 15?
Well, because it's run by the National Guard members and volunteers, right now the camp is for dependents of National Guard members. Special occasions, we may, you know, help, you know, get other kids in there. And we also have, if somebody can't afford to go to the camp, they can submit a waiver to help get their camper paid for.
Well, you know, that's a good segue.
All at our web. What's that?
I said that's a great segue because funding is an issue with any organization, especially, you know, these not-for-profit ones, which the Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp is. And so fundraising, I mean, you're in charge of that. What kind of support do you need from the listening audience, and what are you doing right now to help with raising some funds?
Well, we have sponsors, and people could sponsor. They can go to our website, mngyc.org, and they can sponsor, and we put their sponsorship at their logo at the bottom of our page. But our big thing is that we have a golf tournament, and a woman by the name of Sandy Maxwell and her husband Tom. Tom was a retired warrant officer. They ran the camp and that golf tournament for 13 years. And Sandy passed away this year. So before she passed away, fortunately, we named the camp after her, or the golf tournament after her. So it's the Sandy Maxwell Teed Up for the Kids golf tournament. And that's held at Majestic Oaks Golf Course, and it'll be on August 9th. And so we're looking for sponsors for the tournament. We're looking for people to make donations for the silent auction and the raffles. And that's, you know, we make quite a bit of funds that way for the camp.
And so, Rich, we want to direct people there to mngyc.org. So it's Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp, mngyc.org, where they can get more information about the camp. They can find ways to volunteer. They can find ways to donate funds or even sign up for the golf tournament at Majestic Oaks on August 9th. Did I catch everything?
That's it.
Well, good. Hey, Rich, really appreciate you calling in today and spending a little bit of time with Minnesota Military Radio and sharing some of your thoughts and sharing the Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks, and someday we'll get you back up there.
That sounds good. That's Rich Camp with the Minnesota National Guard Youth Camp. Joining us now is the Roseau County Veteran Service Officer and President of the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers, Marty House. Marty, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Hey, Doug, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
So, Marty, last time that we spoke, we were just in transition, meaning you were in the cities but couldn't stay the extra day. You had to get back up to Roseau, and the same thing happened this time around. We're hoping to get you in the studio. You were here yesterday, and you had to head right back home. What brought you down to the cities yesterday?
You know, that's funny, Doug. You never forget that drive. We were down here. We had a tag meeting. And Major General Mankey was there and hosted myself and my Vice President, Josh Penanga. And we talked about some of the National Guard that's deployed now and how that we can help them out, what we can do for them, because they'll be eligible from when they come back for some of their VA benefits and that, and how we can better get the word out and working with our partners through the Yellow Ribbon and stuff like that, too, to include, assisting those who are nearing that end of their guard time.
And what a great conversation to have, because we cannot forget about our National Guard and Reserve component members. Many of them will be entitled to or earn a lot of these benefits. Speaking of, just things going on, we just came off of this Memorial Day weekend, a lot of different events going on. What kind of participation did the association have this weekend in Memorial Day and other CVSOs?
You know, from talking through all across the state of Minnesota, multiple CVSOs were either engaged in activities with Memorial Day events, or many were speaking at them. And, you know, typically we get called to speak at a lot of them. And so it's been kind of crazy. But I've got nothing but good reports that have come back to me. So everybody's done an excellent job.
Well, that's good. And, you know, we've only got about 2.5 minutes here, but you've got a national conference coming up, right? Tell us a little bit about that and what's going on there.
Yeah, our national conference is being held down in Madison, Wisconsin, and there's going to be CVSOs from all across the United States. We're going to be training on, you know, state or on all kinds of benefits, VA benefits, ethics, things that help us do our job better and things that keep that edge sharp. So when the veteran comes into the office, we're there to help them out. We're there to provide them with what it is that they need. And we're also cultivating those relationships across these United States. So it's a wonderful thing.
And those times together, the training that you you participate in, extremely important, because there's always changes or ever-changing to the benefits and the resources available to our service members, aren't there?
There is. It's constantly changing. And, you know, Minnesota's always kind of been at the forefront of some of that. I hate to sound like I'm, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but we have been. And, I think we'll show that again when we get up here to National. They'll be like, oh, really? And we'll end up maybe educating a few out of the deal, too. So,
well, I think it's all right to brag about Minnesota. And speaking about bragging about Minnesota, with the recent legislation season, there was a pretty interesting bill that was passed relating to vehicle registration. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, real quick. Veterans that have 100% total service-connected disability receive free motor vehicle registration, plate, and title services for up to 2 vehicles, whether it's an auto, a pickup, a motorcycle. So it's a total free exemption, but it does not include personalized plate fees or any required contributions for like specialty plates. And this came through. Kirk Cannon out of Clay County was a big push on that. And, you know, he just did a wonderful job. And I believe it's effective 1-1 of 24.
So January 1st, 2024, the service members, if they're 100% service connected, they're eligible for that. And of course, we always want to remind our service members, go see your county veteran service officer. They are the ones with the knowledge and the insight about all of the entitlements, benefits, and resources available.
You bet. We're here for you. We're here to help. Come see us.
Hey, Marty, thanks so much for joining us on Minnesota Military Radio.
You bet. Thank you, Doug. Have a great day.
That was Marty Howes. He's the Roseau County Veteran Service Officer and also the president of the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a topic, if you have some suggestions about the show, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com, click on the Contact Us button, send us a note. This show is for you, and we want to make sure we're providing you the content that you desire. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Marty Howes, Rich Kemp, Colonel Nathan Asta, Commissioner Larry Herkey of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Sean Mankey. Join us next week. We're going to speak with the President of the Disabled American Veterans of Minnesota. We'll also get an update from the Director of the Minneapolis VA Healthcare System. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Doug Wortham. I'd like to thank you for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I hope you have a great week and find a way to make a positive impact on someone's life.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.